Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. We have a great show today, so stay where you are. We've got a absolutely tremendous guest, a gentleman named Jimmy Young, who's a former Emmy Award-winning talk show host from Boston. We'll give him that. That's okay. He now has Cannabis Media, and he's out there everywhere in cannabis. And thanks to some crack investigative work by my co-host Rob Hunt, we also discovered that Jimmy has more than a few Grateful Dead stories that he can share with us that are going to be very fun and entertaining. We want to listen to that. We're going to be talking about a lot of music today. Dave's Picks Volume 39, which came out the April 26, 1983 show from the Philadelphia Spectrum, as well as acknowledging that we're right upon the 49th anniversary of the Grateful Dead's very, very famous show in Vineta, Oregon, at the Creamery, a benefit show for the Creamery up there. One of the most famous Dead shows ever, one that everyone knows about, has heard about, talks about, and which the Dead, of course, released a few years back as another box set for everyone to run out and grab. And, of course, I did, because that's what I do. But we are going to talk about that. We've got some other great, interesting stuff. Let me start off by saying hello to my co-host, Jim Marty from Colorado. Jim, how are you?
Very good. Enjoying the last days of summer out here in Colorado and looking forward to talking to Jimmy.
Excellent. Excellent. And from the summer home in New York, we've got Rob Hunt of Linnae Holdings. Rob, how's everything with you?
It's great. I'm actually back in California, if you couldn't tell by my background today, Larry. I got back two nights ago, and we are looking forward to talking about the Vineta show, because if there's anything I love, it's Vineta, Oregon. Anyone spent time at Country Fair will attest to the fact that it's a pretty special place. So anytime I get to talk about, you know, Garcia, Ken Kesey, Mountain Girl, and Ken Babbs in the same show, I'm a happy guy.
Well, let's start off with something else right away that's big news. And this is on the marijuana side, where we have Tilray that bought Gotham Green's debt on MedMen. Rob, what can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, if you're following the MedMen story, you know, if you want to talk about kind of unmitigated disasters over the last year, that's certainly one of them. Certainly, there's a couple stakeholders that were holding on to a fair portion of the assets of that company, whether it was Gotham Green or whether it was Inception or a couple other groups. I can't remember the one out of Chicago, but there's a handful of debt holders of that business, and you know, Treehouse being another one, Stable Road being another one. All of them are secured by assets in MedMen. So what's recently happened is Gotham Green, who is probably the largest debt holder, just sold that debt to Tilray, which is a Canadian-based company. And the reason this is newsworthy is, you know, the Canadians have all been trying to figure out a way to enter the U.S. market, but they are, you know, barred from doing so if they're actually directly plant touching. You know, Tilray is a NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange listed company. So if they were to directly touch a plant in the United States, they would lose their listing on a major exchange, and they'd be relegated back to the CSE or the TSX or the NEO. So for them, this is a pretty big move because they're testing the waters of what can be done. They're not directly touching the plant because all they're doing is holding the debt, but they've got it as a convertible. So should legalization happen, then they're able to convert directly into equity of MedMen and take a large equity stake in that company. But in the meantime, they can collect a coupon on the company going forward. So it's a really nice backdoor way for a Canadian company to enter the U.S. market with a company that they think has, you know, strong enough brand appeal and traction that it's worthwhile for them to come in and snatch up at least a portion of the outstanding debt.
Jim, what are your thoughts on it?
A lot of activity, a lot of profitability. We talked about GTI last week, and I'm aware of two other three super large deals that are in the works that are not publicly disclosed yet. So yeah, the mergers and acquisitions in cannabis is very active right now.
What do you see is this like the final swan song of the MedMen saga in, you know, legal marijuana in this country? It's a crazy story. Adam Bierman is an interesting character, and we could probably talk about that all day if we wanted to. What is this? Are they just gone now? They're out of the picture, Rob. All of this is just happening with them on the sidelines.
It is. They're ousted a while ago. And quite honestly, I'd rather, you know, poke myself in the eye with a sharp stick than talk about Adam Bierman for an episode. It's probably the best thing that could have happened to that company to watch him and Andrew Modlin get, you know, ousted out of that business. they left a trail of disaster in their wake. And the people that actually are the debt holders in that business are now trying to figure out what to do. So as I said, it wasn't just one group that was holding the debt, it was multiple groups. And you know, so you think about where MedMen, you know, was located. They had California assets, they had New York assets, they had, I think, Florida for a period. They've sold off, you know, different pieces to different groups. So, you know, a lot of these have been just acquired. So the people that were holding the debt are now, you know, made whole. But the fact of the matter is, you know, say what you want about the founders and say what you want about the issues they had, the brand itself is still a very well-recognized brand. And if you're not in the cannabis industry, you don't know any of that stuff. All you know is that you recognize the name. They've got stores all over the place. And, you know, for a while there, you know, they did a better job branding themselves than any other group from like a marketing perspective. You know, MedMen was terrific. So, you know, there's groups out there that are willing to take a chance despite the fact that the company was just hemorrhaging cash for a long time, that, you know, if they can actually stabilize the business and they can sell off different assets and leave it as kind of one core, you know, MedMen asset that remains, then for somebody it's going to be valuable. It's a question of how. So, you know, what's happened this year is you watched a massive run up in the stock price in early February. It's since then, you know, kind of creeped back down, but it's never creeped back down to the levels it was at back, you know, post the run up in February. So it's got some stability. It certainly has, you know, the Robinhood and the Reddit guys watching it closely. The volume on the stock is great. But it's, you know, it's not even like a top four tier. You know, it's a bit tier player at this point. I think it's a sub-$100 million market cap. And that's largely because it's saddled with so much debt. But if you can fix some of those issues and all you're left with is the brand has value.
Well, and like you say, the real benefit of this is it's hopefully establishing a game plan for how Canadian companies can get involved in the U.S. right now if that's something they desire to do.
Yes, we're seeing some very large and profitable cannabis companies. I was visiting with one of my Colorado clients, and they said they're up to 1,500 employees. I mean, that's a big business. That's not a mom and pop.
No, not at all. Not at all. So, okay, well, you know, the good news out of all of this, guys, that I take away from it every time is that it still amazes me that we're having this kind of conversation about a marijuana company, right? I mean, this isn't, you know, GM we're talking about or Ford Motor or something like that. This is a marijuana company. Those of us around have known Adam Bierman and for a long time, and, you know, whether we like him or not, you know, the history of MedMen has kind of, you know, tracked the arc of, you know, the industry up to this point. But, you know, I like the fact that there's big numbers involved. I like the fact that there's this kind of, you know, corporate intrigue a little bit, because it does, it normalizes, it lets investors take a look at it and say, yeah, these guys aren't any different from anybody else out there. And, you know, without even any regard to legality issues that I know we talk about from time to time, you know, you get normalization in the financial markets to some degree, and boy, that could be, I mean, not that it's not already there, but, you know, the sky's the limit, I would say.
Yes, as I've said many times, we will be at $100 billion legal market by 2030 is my prediction. So we have a long way to go because we're only at about $20, $25 billion annual right now on the legal market. So 70% still the illicit market.
Okay. Well, something to keep our eye on, and be interesting to see how Tilray does. And yes, MedMen still is a very, very strong brand. We have one, but we had one here in Evanston. Now it's Zen Life, but all the stuff inside still says MedMen. And, you know, I'm just old fashioned, although they don't have the red bags, I guess, that were the standard marketing thing for most of those MedMen dispensaries. So moving on for a minute here from our marijuana, although we do have a lot of music to talk about today, we have a guest who's really got some great stories, some great information, and just a great background and a great history to share with us, Jimmy Young. Jimmy, welcome very much to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
I am so honored to be amongst legends like all of you on this show. The fact that you could incorporate me on a Deadhead show alone is quite a thrill for me, okay? I just got to say.
Well, we were very thrilled. You know, we had seen your professional background and your professional history, which was intriguing enough. But like I say, you know, when Rob did about 30 seconds of deep digging, the stories that came to the surface convinced us that you were a guy we had to have on. So we can get to all the dead stuff in a minute.
Larry, I was just going to say, when someone tees it up like that, just take a moment and absorb the fact that finally we have a guest that recognizes greatness.
Thank you.
You know, it's so rare that our guests come on and actually see the hosts for what they are. But Jimmy, thank you. It's taken, 120 episodes before we finally have someone that says, like, so it's a... Thank you, Jimmy, for we'll just bask in that for a quick second, and now we can move on.
Please bask.
This is why I like having Rob as a co-host, because he's got the insight to recognize these moments while I would just barrel forward and not think about it till later. So well played, Rob. Thank you.
Well, hang on a second. Now, you guys are able to actually recite dates, times, concerts. You remember, the playlist of these concerts that you went to. I mean, I'm fascinated by the whole culture, always have been, okay? Just because I was a sports guy doesn't mean I don't appreciate great music, great genius that has been part of the Grateful Dead legacy over my entire life, I will have you know.
Well, I was going to say, right, and we can always get into those stories right away, because anybody who can hang out and talk sports with Bill Kreutzmann until 4 a.m. in the morning, that's a guy I want to get to know.
It happened.
What,
I cannot.
What can you tell us about Billy? Is he a big sports fan? He must be, if he's talking to you all night.
Well, think about it. They all were. They were all Giants fans, right? They were all big baseball fans. You know, since we booked this, I've had an opportunity to meet a guy by the name of, is it Cameron Sears? Who's the head of the foundation. So it turns out he's got a place in Massachusetts on Cape Cod. And during the go-between, between Jerry's birth and Jerry's death, right? I learned about this year. So, it's never too old for a dog to learn new tricks, okay? And found out that he was the one who put together the Oxford Plains Speedway concert in 1988, I want to say, in Oxford, Maine. And I was a sportscaster at the CBS affiliate in Portland, Maine from 1981 to 1992, which is how I got to hang with the Dead one night, actually a few nights. And I heard a reference in the setup where you guys were talking about the helicopter rides that the Grateful Dead used to take from concert to concert or wherever. So they had to take a helicopter from Oxford, Maine to Cape Elizabeth, Maine, where the band was staying at a beautiful beach resort called the Inn by the Sea in Cape Elizabeth that was run by now ex-wife number one and her current husband, who was the general manager of that particular inn, let's just say. But I do remember them landing in a cornfield in Cape Elizabeth at about 12:30 in the morning, and the Cape Elizabeth police had created this heliport with their headlights, right? About 10 of the, I think it was the entire member police force of the Cape Elizabeth, Maine. And the helicopters were landing, and they blared Dark Side of the Moon out of the loudspeakers. And the band coming off the helicopters, I mean, it was a scene from your brain, if you will, of the Dark Side of the Moon and of Pink Floyd's music. And they loved that. They thought that was the coolest thing. And the fact that I was there, and I admit it was 12:30, it was after hours, I was buzzed. I thought it was really cool too. But the coolest thing about that was hanging out with Billy Kreutzmann until 4 a.m. talking about what was higher, closer to the North Pole, Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon. And this was before Google, guys. Okay, so we're thinking, we're looking at a globe, and we're trying to. You guys remember what
I think? It's Maine, isn't it? Did you ever figure it out?
It actually was Portland, Maine, but not by much, and not by much. So yes, but it took us 4 hours to figure it out. It was really a lot of fun, and yes, we did talk about sports as well.
I'll give you a weird stat, Jimmy. The state that's closest to Africa is Maine.
That makes sense because it's down east, as they say. In the world, it is closer to Africa, 100%. But the late Brent Midland was also in the room that night, as was the longtime publicist Dennis McNally, who was from Maine originally. And that was the only concert that I got to go backstage. Not that it was that big of a thrill, to be honest with you guys, because they wouldn't let us go into the areas. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
but we were behind the scenes. But I think it's really funny because it's at the same speedway that I got to interview a great NASCAR legend named Bobby Allison. Okay.
Sure.
And, right? So at the same time, Bob, you know who that is. So I interviewed a legend of NASCAR and then, of course, hung out and partied with the dead after the fact. I mean, it was I've had a blessed life in many, many ways. I mean, I know there aren't very many people in the world who can say that they've interviewed Pele, Hank Aaron, Larry Bird, Steve DeAngelo, Bill Kreutzmann, and a few others, let's just say, through the years from the cannabis world. Bruce Linton is a friend, too. You know, I know you guys know who he is as well. So it's been, like I said, a blessed life for me.
Okay.
Well, are you familiar with some of the stories, the Boston Celtics and the Grateful Dead? Where?
Come on. Wait. Hold on a second. You know I bleed green, right? I mean, I actually watched the Celtics lose the Rookie League Championship game last night to the Sacramento Kings, okay? So, of course I know Bill Walton and the stories of the dead, okay? Come on.
And how he used to load up the Celtics and take them out to Worcester for Grateful Dead shows?
Absolutely. And one of these days, I think I've only... Did I ever interview Bill? I don't know. He was at Larry Bird Night. I was at Larry Bird Night when I interviewed Magic Johnson. But I don't know if I ever got a chance to interview Bill Walton. I would love. That's one of those that's gotten away from me. I would love to interview Bill Walton. If you guys know him well enough to make an intro, because we know enough of the we know enough people in common that we could have a great conversation.
Yes, I'm sure. And then, Jimmy, did you ever get to any of the Grateful Dead shows at the Boston Garden?
I did not at the Boston Garden, but at the Cumberland County Civic Center. They played there once, and I did get to see them there. That was in Portland, Maine. But, guys, look, I listened to them since I was a kid, okay? I mean, I used to wear Jerry Garcia ties every time I did a sports cast in Boston when I had my own show. I used to start my Saturday night show off with, "Hi, everybody, welcome to one more Saturday night sports world with Jimmy Young." I mean, it was just my standard line, you know? I love, you know, what a long, strange trip it's been. I use as many different lines as I possibly can in whatever conversation I have. So while I never dropped acid and followed them around the country, I do appreciate the fact that I've qualified for a Deadheaded Cannabis podcast show. Okay.
You know what's so funny, Jimmy, is that as Deadheads, we always recognize the newscasters or the sportscasters that do that. Whether it's Katie Turr, the way she does it with Fish, or the, you know, Jake Sherman does it with Fish. There's a lot of people, like, we even know, like, in games, like, you know, in the Super Bowl, when it goes to commercial break and you hear, like, a Dead song or a Fish song, you always wonder who the person is that's making that decision. But it's, you know, kind of that whole idea of we are everywhere. You know, you see it all the time, and there's these subtle references that are made, which pretty much gained you an audience, you probably didn't realize it, of Deadheads all over. They're going, "I'm listening to Jimmy Young because that guy, you know, he makes Grateful Dead references." And for me, that's like a deciding factor all the time. You're like, okay, I'll turn on that that newscaster, that sportscaster specifically because I think, okay, they're one of us.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And don't forget, I've always been a champion of the little guy, if you will. I believe in we have an opportunity in the cannabis world right now to right a lot of the wrongs about this failed war on drugs. And I really champion that. I think having Muhammad Ali as a true hero of mine growing up in the 60s, someone who stood up for an unpopular war and was willing to give up his greatest professional years of his life to believe in something that he knew was wrong, still impacts my life in many, many ways.
Yeah. And the way Kaepernick has today.
Right. And even now, as I look into the history of cannabis in the United States and see the role that race has played in this, it really bothers me. It gives me even more passion and drive for continuing to tell the stories about cannabis on our shows and in our content that we share. And we live stream 24/7 on procannabismedia.com. I'm going to give shameless plugs as much as I possibly can, guys. Okay.
Can you repeat that? I think I heard procannabismedia.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's exactly where you can find 24/7 streaming of our Roku channel and our Apple Plus channel. And, of course, we also live stream a couple of shows a week, including The Business of Cannabis, every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern on all of your social media platforms, your Facebooks, your YouTubes, your Periscopes, your Twitches, your wherever else I can put a live stream up. you know?
Well, the best part is that our wonderful producer, Dan Humiston, will make sure all of that information is on the show notes for people who come and watch the podcast. So that's always our closing question is, Jimmy, how can our fans get a hold of you? So
that's right. Well, it's Jimmy at Pro Cannabis Media. And trust me, I get a ton of junk mail because of that, but I don't care, okay? Because it's all part of the deal, right?
And Jimmy, what are some of the recent topics you've explored on your show?
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, I just did a LinkedIn Live about an hour ago with a guy named Rick Thompson out of Michigan. And we were talking about, obviously, the CAO, the Cannabis Administrative and Opportunity Act that our U.S. senators have put out there. And we've talked a lot about how there are elements to that public discussion bill. I don't want to call it a bill yet because it really hasn't been introduced as a bill. It's a draft of a discussion to talk about. But and I think I heard Larry, you said, I pinch myself. We're talking about weed being legalized in the United States of America. I'm 64 years old in a couple of weeks, guys. I never thought in a million years I'd be going from sports talk to weed talk. Okay? It's amazing. What a country, as Don King used to say, right? What a country.
I reinvented myself as an attorney, you know, 25 years out. All of a sudden, I became a popular person to talk to at cocktail parties.
That's it. Well, whatever it takes, Larry, I suppose.
Absolutely.
And when people ask me, by the way, about, hey, where should I invest? You know, I hear cannabis stocks are great. Where should I invest? I go, find a good law firm, because the lawyers are going to make out on this baby for years to come, right?
They can't even get the licenses issued in Illinois without round after round of lawsuits. It's, you know, we just stand at the trough. And once again, I throw this out there every now and then, but my favorite all-time line for that is Jim Marty's line from the very first time I met him at the MJ Biz conference. And he talked to all of us about where the business was and was going to be. And he said, for you professionals, it is a cornucopia of billing.
Yes, exactly.
Cornucopia of billable hours.
Billable hours, 100%. I love that quote. Do I have to attribute that to Jim Marty now?
You sure do.
I do. You know, it's a great line, you know, and it really speaks to what's happening. And yes, as a professional, look, it's wonderful. There's all this great stuff to work on. It beats the hell out of, you know, talking about widgets and stuff like that. And, you know, you get to deal with people who have interests that are common to yours. And what's nice is, you know, you still get people in the industry who are surprised that a lawyer, any lawyer, can come in and, like, start actually talking the talk with them, you know, and can show their bona fides. And, yes, I'm familiar with all of that. And, yes, I've been down that road. And you can talk to me like you talk to your partners and all of that. You know, we're hip, cool, whatever you want to call it. My kids won't call me hip and cool.
Yeah, I was
just call me an old man with a lot of knowledge, for whatever that's worth. So I take that and I'm happy about it.
And I've been called the OWG. Okay, and I'm comfortable with my old white guy status. All right.
Yeah.
It's just, right. But I am painfully unhip when it comes to I listen to the same music I listen to guys in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I just, you know, I'm a classic rock guy. San Francisco Sound, The Airplane. Love them. You know.
So, Jimmy, let me ask you a quick question now with that in mind. When you went to see the Oxford shows in Maine, which was July 2nd and 3rd of 1988, what did you like better, Little Feat as an opener or The Grateful Dead as the main event?
It's a no-brainer. Come on. I love Little Feat. I just heard it on my playlist, okay? Willin, thank you very much. But The Dead, hands down. Come on. There's a reason why there's an opening act and then there's the main act, okay?
You know that Willin was the song that got Lowell George kicked out of Frank Zappa.
I actually heard that, yes. I did know that. That's good stuff, though, man. I love it. I love age-appropriate factoids, you know?
Well, it's one of the great rock and roll songs of all time. It's, you know, one of the great drug reference songs of all time.
Absolutely. And there is one more story that I have to share from that time at the Inn by the Sea. And Larry, we talked about it. I got an opportunity to interview Trixie Garcia a few months ago. And that's up on my In the Weeds podcast, by the way, In the Weeds with Jimmy Young. Make sure you put my name in there, please, because there's about 1,000 other podcasts called In the Weeds, but only one with Jimmy Young, okay? And it's with Trixie Garcia. And it has to do with that time when they were staying for that concert. And I had a dog at the time, and I was walking my dog. And I'm walking my dog around the suite where Jerry was staying. And I knew he happened to which suite he was in, and I was walking my dog, and I looked to my right, And there, about 12 feet away from me in the window, is Jerry Garcia doing the dishes. Now, you know, I it was a really odd thing, right? I'm like, oh, check it out. Jerry Garcia's doing the dishes. He sees me out there. Nice, friendly guy. Waves. I wave back to him. You know, hey, how you doing, right? So, of course, I ask Trixie. I go, Trixie, did he do the dishes all the time? And she says, are you kidding? Never. I never saw him do the dishes, ever. You know, and I said, well, I guess that was a rare sighting then, because I definitely have that embossed in my memory as my up close and personal with Jerry himself.
If you remember what dish detergent he was using, you can make somebody very rich.
No, I don't. And I'll tell you the sad side to this. So grandma on my maternal side many years ago passed away that weekend, guys. So I literally went from 4 a.m. with Billy Kreutzmann to 9 a.m. pallbearer in the synagogue for my grandmother's funeral.
Oh, sorry,
it was
about that.
You talk about a high to a low, but needless to say, I was in a very good mood when it happened. And you know, she lived a wonderful life, and but it was a crazy time in my life. Needless to say, very cool memories. Very cool memories.
Wow. Okay. And what got you into broadcasting in the first place?
So, that's a question that I can answer very quickly. I was an athlete my whole life, I swear. And I did play college soccer in the 70s at Tufts University, my alma mater. I had ripped up my ankle for the second time my junior year. I didn't know what...
Go Jumbos.
Go Jumbos. Who knows about the Jumbos?
I did my last semester of college at Tufts.
Oh, very cool. All right. What year was that, Rob?
I was in my mid-30s. I spent my 20s and late teens skiing and following the dead, so I didn't make it back to college until much later.
You do qualify as a deadhead, then. Congratulations. Yeah, so great time. Anyway, so I ripped up my ankle, didn't know what the hell to do. Friend of mine was a pioneer of Tufts Television, one of the founders of it. And he said, what are you going to do now with all your time that you're not playing soccer? And I go, I really have no idea. And he goes, well, how would you like to produce sports in Boston at Channel 4? And I go, I know nothing about television sports production. He goes, no, you know sports. And I go, yeah, of course I know sports. I love sports. I grew up with sports. I'm from Boston, for crying out loud. And he goes, well, you get college credit to watch sports on TV. And I go, ooh, 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 sign me up for that. I'll take the college credit for watching sports on TV. So that is kind of how I got out of thinking I would be a teacher and a coach my whole life, and became a sports producer at age 20 for the NBC affiliate in Boston, and then was in Portland, Maine at age 23 at the CBS affiliate doing weekend sports, and then came back to Boston, my career goal in 1992, and had my own sports talk show on a 24-hour regional news channel called NECN, New England Cable News. It still exists and was just sold for, I think, $110 million to NBC Universal a few years back. So I didn't screw that one up, and won an Emmy Award for a talk show I created for kids, a sports talk show for kids. So, and in fact, if you are watching the video record of this, I always have it purposely placed over my right shoulder, if you will. I'm very proud of my little trophy. So there you go. That's my story.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. Yeah, we were talking before the show started that you and I grew up watching a lot of the same shows on WBZ in Boston.
Yes, we did. We talked about, I think it was Captain Kangaroo and Rex Trailer and a few other black and white specials, right?
I used to watch them every morning before going to school.
Wow. That's great. I love age-appropriate people, guys. This is awesome.
This is awesome. That's right. And we have to drag Rob along. He's the baby of the group, but he can hold his own pretty well, too, if he has to.
Yeah, but he knew the Jumbos were the mascot of my alma mater, okay? And I'm a three-generation Tufts alum. My father, class of 45, brother, 74, sister-in-law, 76, and niece, 2003. And, yes, I did graduate in 1979, okay?
Wow, okay. So, yeah, you guys have Tufts locked down cold there.
Yeah, yeah.
The same year I graduated from UMass.
That's right, that's right. And that's where my mom went. So we have that East Coast connection. I love that. And it was the dead and weed that brought us together. Let's make sure we understand that. Right, guys?
As much as we can say to people, 100%, you know, it's a great way to live.
In fact, Jimmy, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some Grateful Dead music, and you are certainly welcome to hang out with us for the rest of the hour.
Well, I appreciate that, but I think you guys know I do have a very important appointment coming up in a few minutes that I really do have to get to, because even though I was an athlete once, I've had 4 surgeries in 22 years. It's one of the reasons why I qualified for a medical card in Massachusetts in 2013, and I had horrific back spasms a couple of days ago, and I have got to get to the masseuse that I go to on a regular basis so I can actually function. But I got to tell you what a thrill it's been just to talk about these times with you guys. I so support the cause. I love that the dead are still alive in our hearts and our memories forever. I believe that is Bob Weir coming back with Dead Again or to Fenway Park this summer, or have they already been here? I may have missed that.
But, no. September, early September, and I think they're doing what I used to call Great Woods in Mansfield.
Right, and it's still Great Woods in Mansfield, okay? So there you go. I think the Xfinity Senator, right? A Senate, but Center, but yeah, that is it, guys. And I really do appreciate it. And again, I'm so proud of the fact that we are living to tell the story of those who have made a difference in all of our lives, and how cannabis has saved our lives, cannabis has changed our lives. That's why I started this company, was so that people would have a safe place and a friendly place to go to tell their stories. And obviously the Deadhead Cannabis Show is keeping that spirit alive as well, and I salute all of you. And again, if any of you want to subscribe, like, and share our stuff, I so appreciate it. We're doing great with our – people are discovering what we're doing now, and I'm so proud of the 7 other producers that work with me. We've got a morning show that we do live with the great Green Nurse Group, and our Business of Cannabis show is Fridays at 4 p.m. Eastern. And please, please, please like, share, subscribe. I will do the same to you. And more importantly, as I fade off into the sunset, as I go down the road feeling bad, okay, I'm going to put on some Dead on the way to the masseuse and think of this moment. Because as great as it was that I got thrown in the Charles River by Bobby Orr once, this has been one of the highlights of my broadcast career. I really do believe.
Well, now we're going to have to bring you back to hear that story.
Yeah, I know how that works too, guys. You know how to find me.
I'm the St. Louis Blues fan who still has nightmares of him soaring through the air after he scored the winning goal in OT.
Oh, at Glenn Hall, was it Glenn Hall in goal?
Noel Picard.
Yeah.
Yeah, Glenn Hall was in goal and Noel Picard
hit
him.
That's right. And I've seen the autographed pictures. I've got the autographed pictures of both Noel Picard and Glenn Hall and Bobby Orr. It's awesome. Happy to tell you that story on another show, guys. More importantly, you're coming on my show.
We will.
Okay?
Can't wait. Can't wait. I was a paper boy for the Boston Globe, and I delivered that newspaper with Bobby Orr diving across the front of the net.
I hope you saved a copy, okay?
I've been waiting my whole life for Bobby Orr to throw me in the Charles River.
I can tell you that story, and there is video that exists of that as well, guys. So I look forward to continuing this conversation with you guys.
Excellent.
Keep up the good work, and again, thank you for allowing me to come on.
That's actually a great segue because, you know, Jimmy was talking about Trixie Garcia, and we were going to talk a little bit about Vineta, Oregon. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Trixie wasn't just raised by Garcia, but she was also raised by Mountain Girl and Ken Kesey. And anyone that's been to Vineta, Oregon and been to the Country Fair will realize that, you know, Ken Kesey was really the muse behind the Country Fair and a lot of the things that happened up there for many, many years. So if we're going to talk about Oregon, we're going to talk about Vineta. There's no possible way we can do it without talking about Ken a little bit, without talking about the Springfield Creamery and the Vineta show from, I believe it was August 27th, 1972. Is that right, Larry?
That's correct. Yep. So we're sneaking up on a 50th anniversary here. And it is a great show. And for our listeners, we're swinging into this for a minute, but we are going to circle back around to Dave's Picks 39. So if you're waiting to hear about that one, please hang tight. But Vineta, given the fact that it's an anniversary and the significance of the show, I guess, you know, what I like about it is it's certainly one of the times when there was a big show and the Dead lived up to the bill and really delivered with, you know, just a classic performance. You know, there's been many a time when everybody gathered saying tonight's going to be the night for Jerry to explode, and he explodes in the wrong direction. But this show was just solid from start to finish. The music is great. The song selection is great. The energy from the crowd is great. And in the box set from the Dead, the music is wonderful, but they also give you the Sunshine Daydream film that was about this show. It's something that everybody should check out if you haven't. And you can go online and find most of this content that I'm talking about. But, you know, people kind of talk about it with a certain level of awe and reverence. And I have to say, I have never been out to Veneta, so I can't comment on it in person. But, Rob, you've been there.
I have been there, and I was actually meant to go to a Grateful Dead show there on August 22nd, 1992, which was canceled. They canceled five nights in 1992, and that was one of them. So I had tickets in hand. I was supposed to go see the Dead play there. But I've been there for Country Fair a couple times, and I can tell you that, you know, if anyone out in the audience has been to Country Fair, it used to be that you could camp and stay there all night, and there was probably no stranger place in the world than camping at Country Fair. And it got to be such a scene that they ended up, you know, kind of making it invite only, and they had what was called, I think it was called the Veneta Navy, which was Kesey and all the rest of the pranksters, you know, Babs and all the rest of those guys that would send their guys to patrol the river that surrounded the fairgrounds for the most part. And if you didn't have an invite in at night, you couldn't come, because what happened, you know, late at night was stuff of legend, and everyone wanted to be a part of it, but there just wasn't enough room for everyone to be there, so they'd limit it to, you know, a couple hundred people. So I'll tell you that that's some of the craziest things I've ever sort of seen, or not sure I've seen in my life, happened on that island at night at the Veneta County Fairgrounds. But that fair is still going on, and for anyone out there that has not gone to see, you know, Veneta Country, or the Oregon Country Fair in Veneta, you know, definitely make it a point sometime in your life to go check it out. That's one of the last great areas, and it's, you know, set up as a Renaissance fair. So there's all sorts of infrastructure there for like jousting and puppets and other cool stuff. So it's, you know, the closest thing we have in the East Coast is Bread and Puppet in Vermont, but the Veneta County Fairgrounds were set up specifically to kind of put on different events and different plays with two or three different stages around the spot, and these great pathways that would lead from one area to the other. So really, really cool, and not too far from Eugene, which is, you know, it's a great area.
Well, I have never been to that part of the world, and I am dying to get out there, and I'm sure that I will, unfortunately, not to see the Grateful Dead play, but still to take in all the beauty of it that's out there. And that's one of the things that really comes through on this music from Veneta, is just the, you know, the great energy they have going and everything that's happening with them. I personally am a big fan of Bertha in the first set. They play it totally out of location for where it normally goes. Jerry's on fire with it. And you know,
it's a set closer.
Well, that's true, actually. It is the set closer, which is very rare if you talk about it. The first set closer, that almost, I can't ever remember that for Bertha. And then it, in the second set, or the third set, at least the way they label it in the CD disc box, they've got a 31-minute Dark Star that spills over into El Paso. And I guess there was just a period of time for them in 70, late 70, 71, and early 72 maybe, where for some reason El Paso got matched up with Dark Star quite often. And, you know, I've seen it on a couple of recordings that they've released where either right in the middle of the Dark Star they break into El Paso and then go back to Dark Star, or they use it as a lead-in or a lead-out. And don't know why, but on this recording it sounds really, really good.
Well, that's why that set is such a strange one. It's a four-song third set that starts off with a monster Dark Star and then goes into two country tunes. I think it's a Marty Robbins tune in El Paso and then a Merle Haggard song in Sing Me Back Home. And then they come back with classic Grateful Dead with a Sugar Mags closer. So it's like, you know, you go from the ultra-psychedelic to two country tunes to kind of like your classic Americana Grateful Dead and Sugar Mags. It's such a strange four-set combination pairing, but somehow it works really well.
Yes, I heard an interview recently with Bob Weir talking about that, and he said back in the 60s, the rock and roll stations in the Bay Area played a lot of country western, and that's where they got the Marty Robbins, the Merle Haggard, the Johnny Cash songs came into the repertoire of the Grateful Dead.
And I'm glad they did. You know, it's great music. They kind of took it and made it their own. For me, it definitely opened the door into other musicians that I might not have ever found my way over to, but for the fact that the Dead were covering their music. So I thought, oh, well, I might as well go check out the original and hear what it's all about. So Veneta is a great show. Hard to believe it's 49 years ago. The stories are legend. Check them out. Read about it. If you don't know who Ken Kesey is, by all means, you got to read about Ken Kesey. Babs, the Waldos were involved with the Dead back in the day. You know, the Waldos are always fun to talk about as well. The group that is unofficially credited with coining the 420 phrase. So, you know, they're always a popular conversation piece.
And for our younger listeners, a must read is Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Yes.
Well, I was going to say a must read also is Ken Kesey's books. You know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest gets all the attention, but I think Sometimes a Great Notion is a probably a better book. So if anyone wants to know what being a logger was like.
And a great movie.
Yeah, and a terrific movie. You know, it's a very, very tragic movie. And I think the sense of desperation towards the end of being sort of pinned by a log in the river is a tough one. If anyone doesn't understand the reference to the title of the book, it was the, I think it's the Lead Belly song. It's Goodnight Irene. So the title of the book is taken from the line, sometimes we live in the country, sometimes we live in the town, sometimes we take a great notion to jump in the river and drown. And that was, you know, the sort of the thought behind the idea of writing a book about loggers that, you know, ultimately pay the ultimate price for logging on the river.
Ken Kesey is amazing, and the combination of him and the Dead and the Pranksters is another topic for another day, because getting to talk about the acid tests and all the craziness that they all did. But it is fun to kind of talk about it and kick it around and to always look into it and to see what's happening. Let's turn our attention then back over to Dave's picks, 39 for a minute. Jim, what are your thoughts on that release?
Well, I've been listening to it quite a bit, a couple times all the way through, out in my barn at good solid volume. And I have to say, an amazingly long show, two segments of space.
Yes.
And a fine, fine Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's Tower. Yes. Really enjoying the heck out of it. You know, there's a good Truckin' on there. I think they come out of space into Truckin'. There's a killer Morning Dew. So, really enjoying the heck out of Dave's Picks 39.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Truckin', Jim, because the music I'm going to ask Dan to tee up for us here in a second comes towards the end of the Truckin', as it's getting ready to transition into the Morning Dew. And by the way, the Morning Dew is tremendous too, but we're going to focus on the Truckin' for a minute. Number one, it's a 1983 Truckin', and 83, I think the boys were, you know, at the height of their powers, at least for my era of seeing them. And, you know, there were 1995 Truckins where it felt like they were going through the motions. In 83, they were living it. And if you listen to the entire song, which we won't have time to do, you can really hear that coming through. Bobby's voice, Jerry's playing is just crisp and clear and as good as it could be at that point in time. But where we're going to pick it up is towards the end. And since we don't let our clips run for very long, it's kind of hard to squeeze in two important parts that I want to get. But we're gonna start right around the 5:43 mark of the song, so that we can catch Phil's big bass bomb. And you have to be listening for it because it's going to happen right away. But this was Phil when he was just out there having a good old time and making your knees rock, even if you were sitting back in the last row. But what the real joy of this transition for me is that as you get out of the Truckin' and start to go a little bit farther down, Jerry jumps into a tease of Nobody's Fault But Mine. Nobody's Fault But Mine is a tremendous number that the Dead did from time to time. I saw him do it in 1985 in Kansas City, and it's just a great song. So without any further ado, The Grateful Dead from April 26, 1983 at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. Thank you. That's hot, guys. That's as good as it gets. I mean,
man, Phil is just thundering on his bass.
Oh, it just, I love that, you know, and having just seen Fish, and meaning zero disrespect to Fish, because I love Fish, you know, but, and I love Mike Gordon when he's up there at the beginning of A Week Apart Groove, and he's really playing that bass, you know, frenetically, but, you know, there's just something special about a Phil bass bomb when he just, you know, gets in the mode just like that, and he drops two or three of them in a row, and really, you could be sitting in the last row of the auditorium, and your knees still knock from it. It's just, if, you know, if you never experienced it live, try and go find Phil and friends and see if he'll give you one, because once you felt it, you know, there's no going back. But I love the way Jerry just kind of picks up on the a slight hint of Nobody's Fault But Mine and jumps right into it and really takes it and runs with it for a minute there. And another thing about Fish that I really like on their webpage is when they list all the songs, the guy gives the content at the end and says, in the middle of this, Trey teased that, and Mike teased this, and that. And I would love that, you know, for the Dead, you know, to, for somebody to compile, to go back through some of their shows and just mention all the times they tease tunes without ever really going into them. Because if you were there that night, boy, at that moment you thought we're getting Nobody's Fault But Mine, and they turned out of it. Now, they went into Morning Dew, so I don't think too many people were disappointed. It's just a great piece of music.
Could have been a Spoonful also.
You know, I was thinking about that as well.
Yeah, they tease Spoonful in the middle of that.
Yeah, they did drop in a Spoonful, and you know, they can play them all sometimes, so they're almost indistinguishable. But it was a great tease, and I suppose coming out of Truck and Spoonful would have been the logical call, which was something that was not uncommon for them to do back in the day. And Spoonful is always a fun tune to hear Bobby sit there and, you know, try and crank out some blues and everything, and he does a respectable job, I suppose. But this is just really a great show from a great period in the Grateful Dead life, and in a venue that, you know, was a pretty run-of-the-mill hockey arena for the most part, right in the middle of Philadelphia's Sports Arena Row there, where they had the Vet and
JFK,
right, JFK, and the Spectrum all lined up one after another. And I have to confess, I never saw a show in the Spectrum, but I have friends who did. My wife saw one there, and very rarely did I hear somebody come out of the Spectrum and complain about a show that they saw there. More often than not, they were raving about it. And
I got arrested in the Spectrum.
Oh, for?
Just, you know, going to a Dead show.
Smiling on a cloudy day.
General nuisance for breaking into the NBC press box and you know, drinking all their beer, but nothing serious.
That I could see where that, you know, where they might do that. But in a little foreshadowing for people who like to plan ahead, be sure to tune into our show early April of next year, because we will absolutely be talking about the Dead's '82 show at the Spectrum, and what I think is the greatest Shakedown Street ever played. It's an amazing place. It brought out the best in them, and it's not surprising to get a good release out of there. And I'm glad that Dave is focusing a little bit more on our era. You know, Jimmy liked to talk about being age appropriate. Well, for me, age appropriate is, you know, the shows from '82, '83, '84, '85, and that whole era that's woefully unrepresented in the Dick's Picks and Dave's Picks lexicon today. So hopefully, we're gonna get more out there.
So for the last couple of weeks, I've been teasing a book review by, I think, one of the finest books on that era of the 60s and 70s by Roni Gizem Stanley, who was with Stanley from the early days, from 65, right up through when he died in 2012. They were great friends, lovers, mother of Starfinder. And so she met him when she was going to college in San Francisco around 1965 with another young woman by the name of Melissa Cargill. And those two women had a love triangle with Bear. And they were his assistants in the lab. And they helped him batch his LSD. And she has such great inside stories of Bear and how he, you know, kept wads of $100 bills in his boots. And, you know, his whole business theory on LSD was that it was a community service. He wasn't really doing it for the money. And this inside story she has, she was rode with Jerry on the helicopter to the stage at Woodstock. And a few weeks ago, we had Sandy Troy talk about how there was a skinny dipping lake behind the stage at Woodstock. Well, she went skinny dipping with Phil Lesh. I mean, she has just great stories. She was right there for the whole thing. She was at Altamont. She knew the Hells Angels. She had sex with Terry the Tramp. I highly recommend this book.
That's something you like to go home and tell your mom.
My Life with Owsley Stanley, My LSD Family by Roni Stanley. So good stuff. And, you know, like I said in an earlier show, so many of the Grateful Dead books, they're almost all written by men. The Grateful Dead are all men. It's from a man's perspective. This is totally from a woman's perspective and what the free love was like in the 60s and, you know, what somebody was wearing the first time she had sex with him and just the things that only a woman would know. She talked about how they would get dressed up real sexy with pump high heels that she called come fuck me pumps.
Okay.
So very much a woman's point of view. Great book.
I will say.
First of all, I love the fact you brought Melissa Cargill because she's like the unsung hero of the LSD movement. Everyone knew about Bear. Everyone knew that Owsley was doing his thing. And, you know, Tim Scully was the other guy that a lot of people knew about. But Melissa Cargill went on and continued to make LSD for a long time. And both, you know, both Bear and Melissa came from pretty affluent families. This wasn't something, you know, wasn't something they had to do. Bear was a kind of a trust fund baby and was out there just turning on the entire world. So, you know, for all the people that don't know the history of LSD and kind of how it was disseminated throughout the United States in the 70s, you know, go read the history of Melissa Cargill and of Tim Scully and of Owsley Stanley, and definitely read the book that Jim's making reference to.
Yes, and there's another great book, and I forget who the author is, but the name of the book is Bear. Both Melissa Cargill and Roni were with Bear when he got arrested, and he covered for them. Oh, these chicks were just hanging out at the house. Meanwhile, they were actually very smart chemists.
Yeah, Melissa's a great chemist.
And the other thing that Bear did, he, as soon as he figured something out, and in this book, there's actually sketches of his lab equipment and how he made LSD. And actually, his last batch was made here in Denver. And back in those days, there was no airport security. He flew back with a giant crystal of LSD that he would batch into, you know, 250, 270 milligram capsules that sold for $3 a piece. And just such great, you know, all kinds of stories about that. But yeah, they rented a house here in Denver and batched it. And many years later, do I have the name right? Albert Hofnagel, who actually invented LSD in the 40s in Europe?
Albert Hofmann, who did it for Sandoz Laboratories, which is now Novartis, did it in Switzerland. But that's right.
Bicycle Day.
Oh, yeah, Bicycle Day. Yeah, I actually have some paper in my freezer that has bicycles on it. And anyway, John Barlow ran into him many years later, before Albert Hofmann passed away, at some kind of a conference. And Albert Hofmann said, Bear got it. He was the only one that figured it out, and he got it. And what he used to do, Bear, he would, as soon as he figured something out on how to make 99% pure LSD, he would share his information with the other chemists in the industry who were making, you know, illicit market LSD. So the fact that we still have very good LSD out there, you can thank Bear for being generous with his information. That's when he got arrested, he told the cops it was for his personal use. And, you know, and he always, like I said, he thought, you know, and people really thought this, and they still do that, and we're looking at all the violence right now in Afghanistan, that LSD would make the human race less violent and more peaceful. That was really a belief that people had in the 60s and 70s, and Bear was part of that. He wanted to turn as many people onto LSD as he possibly could.
Well, I've eaten a lot of LSD and I haven't killed anyone, so maybe it's true.
Well, or look, if you just find a way to get it, you know, sent over to the Taliban and convince them to take it, then we might really be in good shape. Right. Oh, well. Well, okay, guys, great show today. A lot of topics covered in a slightly extended format today, time-wise. Again, thank you very, very much to our guest, Jimmy Young, who joined us earlier in the show. Great conversation with my co-hosts, Jim and Rob, on the Vanita Oregon show, on Dave's Picks 39 from Philly in 1983, on Owsley Stanley. And we always seem to have more topics than we have time to talk about. So that's a good thing. Anybody got any live music coming up?
We got three Fish shows Labor Day weekend. They just announced you will need to show proof of vaccination. So I downloaded mine from Walmart.com.
Yep, I saw that they're going to start requiring that. So good, that'll be fun in Colorado that weekend. That's my son's wedding, and all of his Fish buddies will be, unfortunately for them, at the wedding and not at Dick's. But they'll be checking, you know, their phones every night to follow along and see what they're missing. So hopefully, as much as I hope you have great shows, Jim, I hope that they're not the greatest shows of all time. So my son has to live with the ignominy, or whatever the word is, of having got married and pulled everybody away from Dick's at the wrong moment.
Well, they're playing really well.
They are.
You can always send your kid over to Jim's freezer, you know, prior to the wedding.
just give us the passcode. It's all good. Absolutely.
Two popsicles, some ice cream, a steak, and the bicycles.
Absolutely. Okay, guys. Well, thank you all very much. Jim, any parting words?
Just over and out from Denver, Colorado.
Very good. Rob?
We'll see you next week for another fun week of the Deadhead Canvas Show.
Absolutely. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy your live music if you get out to see it. Stay safe, be healthy, and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Season 1 of Dope History is now available at dopehistory.com. Dope History weaves you through the lives of those who have been touched by cannabis or have had an influence on the events that shaped our laws or relationships with this plant. You'll hear tales from Frenchie Cannoli, Keith Strop, Eddie Lepp, Tom Alexander, Ed Rosenthal, Wolf Seagall, Jorge Cervantes, and Tommy Chong. Available now at dopehistory.com.